This is Common Threads, an interfaith dialogue.
I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. When I think of China, many things come to mind, and one of them is how I think of it as the land of great disappointment. By this I mean that when I reflect upon the legacy of the art, spirituality, innovation, and native intelligence, I am so, well, disappointed in what China has become today. A totalitarian communist government that oppresses many forms of spirituality, religion, speech, assembly, and personal liberty. The Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward, all euphemisms for a human rights nightmare. One can hope that at some point in the future there will be a return to a sense of harmony that is extolled in the Tao Te Ching. So today we will discuss China's spiritual legacy, along with sizing up its current religious landscape, with a longtime friend of Common Threads, Dr. Kelly Clark. Kelly has had a pretty impressive and diverse academic career. His appearances on Common Threads in times past have revolved around his publications on neuroscience and religion, interfaith cooperation, and the philosophy of religion. His PhD is from Notre Dame, and he has held positions at Calvin, Oxford, St. Andrews, as well as with the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, the parent organization of Interfaith Dialogue Association. And he is the former executive director of the Society of Christian Philosophers. Kelly's latest book is titled A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. So we welcome to Common Threads, Kelly Clark. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Fred. Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Certainly. I'm not going to use the word unique, but are you rare in that you have such a diverse portfolio of interests academically? Let me explain, most of the academics that I have on the air, when I look at their resume, they are really, really specific to a field. You seem to be broader than most. Is that rare in academia?
It is rare, Fred. I am a dilettante, so I like a lot of things, and I follow out my interests, and I probably have some sort of ADD, and I just, if I see a rabbit over there, I look over, and then I start chasing it.
And then a squirrel.
Once you get tenure, you can do whatever you want, and I think a lot of academics don't realize that. There's such a pressure to specialize in contemporary academia, and I have resisted that pressure.
You know, it just occurred to me, we're sitting here, there's a microphone in front of you, a microphone in front of me, and it just seems so wrong that these microphones really should be finely crafted artisanal beers.
Amen.
Because that is often where we exchange information.
Yeah.
But today, we're in a different environment. So tell me, how did your interest in China develop?
Everyone thinks it's good to diversify, and diversity is good, but most philosophy departments don't usually have anything at all in Chinese philosophy or Hispanic philosophy or Arabic philosophy or Muslim philosophy. And I knew nothing about any of those, but I had met when I was on sabbatical in St. Andrews, I had met a Chinese philosopher from China, and he invited me to his country. So I set up an exchange between my university and his university, and we started sending professors back and forth. And then I got invited by the Society of Christian Philosophers to participate in one of their annual dialogues with Chinese philosophers, and they were in China, And I went, and I got invited back, and then I was invited to be in charge of those, to start running them and try to work to improve them a bit. But one thing I realized is that we didn't really have a dialogue because no one really listened to each other. That the Christian philosophers were primarily interested in persuasion / maybe evangelism, which I think is detrimental to dialogue. You can't go in with your, because evangelism cuts off listening, and there's no dialogue. So I decided at that point that I was going to learn Chinese philosophy, that I needed to be a listener. And it's strange because I had also taught Chinese philosophy. I failed to mention that. I thought...
really?
Yeah. I had been to China once, so my department thought it would be a good thing to have a Chinese philosophy class. So my qualification was I had been to China once. And I thought it would be like easy to pick up some specialty in China, but Chinese philosophy was very different than Western philosophy, in part because, like Confucius, the Analects, it's full of, anecdotes. Yeah, it's full of anecdotes, just little tiny stories without any context, or maybe a saying or a name that I don't understand. And not all the passages are from Confucius. They're from some disciple or something. And so, like the first one just says, is it not good when someone comes to visit from afar? And I read it and I thought, well, it's always nice to have visitors. You know, it's not an unsullied blessing. Yeah, you have to make your house clean and you have to cook and create, you know. But like, I didn't get why this was important. And then I came to learn after a long time that part of the point was, like, if you're a good person, you will attract people to yourself. Like, good people are attractive, and almost in a magnetic sense. And so when they're saying, like, isn't it good to have visitors come from afar, they're saying it's good for you to be the kind of person that people want to spend time around. And that's a morally virtuous person, and they're attractive and unassuming and humble and kind and compassionate. That's the kind of person they're talking about. Well, I had no idea when I read it. But at any rate, I sort of backed my way in and decided to become expert in Chinese philosophy.
Can you do that without mastering, say, Mandarin or Cantonese?
Well, there's no way to do it really at the top of the academic game unless you know Mandarin, not Cantonese, but mm-hmm. Mandarin. You have to know Mandarin, and probably even if you want to be the best, even the earliest Chinese scripts that to which modern day Mandarin is only distantly related. I made up for my lacks by learning the key philosophical terms in the original languages and their semantic range, an expert might state it. But I also would work with someone if I published, and I didn't actually intend to publish in Chinese philosophy. I was asked to write articles when people would hear me talk. I would work with people who were expert in the Chinese language.
I'm curious, this forum where you had Chinese philosophers and Christian philosophers, or Western philosophers in general, right? It was more broad than that. It was more than just Christian.
No, it was just Christian philosophers and Chinese philosophers.
Yeah. And by Chinese, we're not talking simply about their ethnicity, but also their philosophical proclivities.
Well, yeah. Mostly ethnicity, but we would also have like a conference on Confucianism or something. So they would all be people that at least wrote about Confucianism or
right.
Taoism or
yes.
But so, they could be on anything. So
sure. So my question is: were the Chinese familiar with Plato, Kant, Descartes, etc., more than the Westerners were familiar with Confucius, Lao Tzu, and all of that? Or was there parity?
Well, there's an odd parity, and you know, you mentioned how communism crushed China.
Yes.
Here's a way it crushed China. The four olds were, one of them was Confucius, and they crushed the four olds. They wanted to be new. They wanted to be contemporary. So under Chairman Mao, not only did no one learn anything about Confucius, nobody was allowed to learn anything about Confucius, and Confucius was vilified. Confucius was bad. And so I think you would be shocked at how little most Chinese philosophers know about Confucius, because when I'm dealing with them, say, in 1998, Confucius has been a bad guy for 50 years almost, and just roundly vilified. So no 48-year-old philosopher will know anything at all. There were no courses in the university about Confucius.
So give me a comparison. The West would have Plato and Socrates. The Chinese would have, if they didn't have Confucius, they had, who would they come to the table with?
Well, they came to the table with nobody.
Really?
Yeah, it was very sad. I'll just give you an example. I'll just tell you another story to help you see the problem. During Mao, all the universities were closed, so there weren't any real universities in all of China for a long time. They just closed them. And then they took all the sort of bad people that taught the olds, and they moved them out to farms and had them grow crops and learn what it meant to like be a peasant. They needed to be re-educated. Well, when the Cultural Revolution was over, they didn't say, okay, go back and start teaching again. The philosophy departments were filled with communists. And so what did they know? They would learn Mao Zedong thought, they would learn. They would learn Lenin thought. They would learn Marx thought and Stalin thought. That was philosophy for probably 20 years. And then, so we would go and we'd hear people defending that. If they did write about Confucius, honestly, after 2 years of teaching Confucius, I knew more about Confucius than a lot of Chinese professors. Anyways, the state of the humanities in China, it still hasn't recovered from the effects of the Cultural Revolution.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Dr. Kelly Clark. We're talking about his latest book titled A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. I've got a question about the title. What sorts of spirits are we talking about? Spirits, gods, ancestors, and afterlife, and you call it a spiritual geography.
Yeah, I would have called it like Spirit-Yule, so not to confuse it with some sort of self-help book about getting spiritual advice from, or spiritual succor or something like that from the early Chinese. I'm looking at the spirit world in early Chinese thought, and I'm looking at it with, by the way, an Oxford historian. So you asked, don't you have to know Chinese? He teaches Chinese at Oxford and at Cambridge. So I have a co-author who is expert in the language and also works in this broad area with me.
And his name?
His name is Justin Winslet. And I noticed, and Justin was appreciative of this, that most philosophers, this is the impact of spirits in early Chinese thought. So mine's a spiritual geography of early Chinese thought. Like so I'm more interested in the thought part. He's more interested in the religion and spirits part of it. I wanted to see what implications did these beliefs have for what we call Confucianism or Taoism or other forms of Chinese thought. That's what I was interested in. But I noticed this, that almost all philosophers denied that there were spirits in early Chinese thought. Almost all contemporary philosophers that work on China say things like, the Chinese aren't religious. There is no God in China. The Chinese don't believe in the afterlife. Confucius doesn't have a God. Confucianism doesn't have a God. And at first I just believed them, but and taught that to my students. But then I started reading other documents that kind of surround early Chinese thought, and I thought, oh, the authors of this text believe in a God, believe in an afterlife, they believe in ghosts. There are all sorts of spirits running around this world, and I came to the conclusion that early China was a spirit-haunted world. It's in Confucius. It's in almost every thinker you can think of in early China. So it totally changed the way I began to think about Chinese thought.
Now, would somebody in China who's teaching early philosophy, would they want to agree with these Westerners who claim that the spirituality would be shallow or without any belief in a higher power? Would that serve their purposes better today if they continue to teach that in China?
Yeah, it would serve their purposes better, and
yes.
We may come to this later, but it's politically better.
Yes.
In order to be a professor at a Chinese university, you have to be a member of the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese Communist Party may be one of the most capitalist parties in the world,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't like any threats to its power, and one big threat to its power is religion. And so it still wants to control religion, and in the past more than a decade, it's sort of fought a battle against religion. And most professors are... they want to stay professors. They have good jobs. They're happy with their jobs. You know, I know professors who were students during the Tiananmen Square so-called massacre. I actually don't think there was a massacre at Tiananmen Square. So I think there are a lot of myths that Westerners perpetuate. At any rate, they were student leaders in the democratic movement. Well, there basically isn't one anymore. And there hasn't been for over 30 years. And there hasn't been for over 30 years because most people, including most professors, live pretty good economic lives, and they don't want to rock that boat. So most of them aren't going to teach much of interest about religion.
I've often wondered, why do they still call it a communist party when it is such a capitalist society these days?
I don't know. It's communist in name only. I guess they didn't want to give up the name. They try to say how they're still communist. It's always like communism with Chinese characteristics. Well, that just means capitalism. But they always add on with Chinese characteristics to whatever they're talking about. Economics with Chinese characteristics. And so that gets added on, but de facto, it's not. People don't live in communes. They don't work together. They don't give to everyone according to their need. It's more capitalistic than the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
That's quite a statement.
Yeah. Maybe not in law, but in fact, it is. I mean, they. A lot of laws in China are just mostly ignored, like environmental laws. We have all sorts of them that protect our country for the common good and probably should have more. They have those laws in China. They would be for the common good. They're completely ignored. The biggest lake in China is completely dead because they just, for years and years and years, pumped chemicals into it. It's surrounded by chemical plants. They pump chemicals into it. They can't grow crops within, I think it's 5 miles of that lake because the water's so polluted. So, and the only person punished for the pollution in that lake is the person that reported it and said, these people are violating laws. That's the only person that has ever been punished, even though the biggest lake is dead.
I would gather that if you took a poll of people who knew very little about China, didn't study it, but just know what they hear on the street, and if you were to ask them what is the religion, the main religion in China, I suspect a fair number would say Buddhism.
Yeah.
What is the now, and I know we have two different, actually you could call it three different Buddhisms to my way of thinking. So hear me out on this. First of all, we have true Tibetan Buddhism in Tibet, which also, of course, meaning that the Buddhism that is directed by the Dalai Lama and his disciples. Yeah. Then you have the Chinese version of Tibetan Buddhism, where they pick their own leaders. And then you have a Buddhism that has nothing to do with Tibet, just Chinese Buddhism. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. The Tibet is changing quite dramatically. You know, the Dalai Lama doesn't live in Tibet, doesn't live anywhere in China. And in fact, you know, I said Confucius was portrayed as a bad guy. I was in a photograph exhibit somewhere in China with some college university students from China, and there was a photograph of the Dalai Lama, and I thought, oh, this is cool, the Dalai Lama. He's all right. All of the Chinese students had a disgust reaction to the Dalai Lama. He's a bad guy in China. And I was kind of shocked. I suppose, portraying my biases, they were portraying their biases. And it was clear to me that it wasn't worth me arguing over. They were quite invested in him being a bad guy. Not that they had thought about it a lot, it's just that that's what their culture had told them. So China moved in, I think it's 1948, into Tibet for what they call the liberation.
Yeah.
And
you mean like what Putin's doing in Ukraine?
Exactly. They're exactly. And in the liberation, when they went, there were 9,000 Buddhist temples. By the time Tibet was fully liberated, there were 13. Basically obliterated any physical manifestations of Tibetan Buddhism. The Dalai Lama escaped. I don't think this is the case yet, but I'm sure the plan is for Han Chinese, the main ethnic group in China, and the ruling group. They force people to move to Tibet. And I don't think this is true yet, but I think pretty soon there will be more than 50% of Han Chinese
yes.
in Tibet. And if they vote, they will not vote to be either separated from China. They will not vote for their real liberation, and they would vote to remain part of China, mm-hmm. and they would be anti-Buddhist. So, so that's Tibet, and there is a Chinese Buddhism, and it's official. There are official religions in China. Buddhism is allowed, even though Tibetan Buddhism was basically destroyed. Buddhist temples were destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. You can go
all
over China. You can go online. You can see black and white videos of statues and Buddhist temples being thrown out. And then the Communist Party would use those as for their offices. Buddhism entered China, I think, like around the 2nd century AD, mm-hmm. and spread pretty widely. If you ask people what they were for a long time, most people would say they were Buddhist. They might still say it if they didn't say atheist. But Buddhism is pretty skin deep for most people in China. Buddhists don't go to a weekly service. They're not in Bible studies. They might go on a high holy day.
You probably mean sutra study.
Yeah, I mean the equivalent. They don't go to Sunday school or Friday school.
Right.
They might once a year go and have a service for their ancestors. That's Buddhists, they might go to a temple once a year, but the Buddhism in China...
What you might call Christmas and Easter Buddhists, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's no surprise since the Chinese government worked so hard against the four olds, and they were quite successful. Anyway, so those are Buddhisms running around there. The more vibrant religions in China are Christianity and Islam by quite a bit.
Would any of these professors that you talked about who want to maintain their good standing with the Communist Party, would they ever identify as Buddhist if, in fact, they really were? Or is it better to say, to check the nun box?
I think it's way better to check the nun box. Yeah. No, I asked somebody one time, I said, we come all the way over here and we've done this for years. You've heard us. We defend what we believe. If we believe we have a soul or mind that's distinct from our bodies, we defend that. If we believe in a certain view of free will, we defend it. Whatever, we defend what we believe. But you give a talk about Confucianism, and I talk to you privately, and I know you're not a Confucian, and I talked to you. Someone defended a paper on Taoism. I know no one's a Taoist. Someone wrote a paper on Buddhism, but I know they're not Buddhists. Nobody defends what they believe. And
it's purely academic.
And I asked someone before, can I ask this question? Because I didn't want to put anyone on the spot. And somebody said, yeah, you can ask it. Well, but before this guy got up to answer, people got up and shut both the doors to the room and are like, you know, everyone's cowering down. And you could see people feel awkward. And this guy's saying, we're afraid to say what we believe. And we don't really believe anything. Like, they beat belief out of people. So...
And let me stop you right there, because we are out of time for this episode, but there's still so much more we need to investigate here, Kelly. So we'll do this again next week.
All right. See you in a week.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGBU. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Dr. Kelly Clark. We're talking about his new book, A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. I'm Fred Stella, and this is WGBU.
Common Threads is a production of WGBU in cooperation with the Interfaith Dialogue Association. The views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the station, its underwriters, or Grand Valley State University. In many cases, the participants on this program represent themselves and may not be designated spokespeople for the faiths they represent. Send questions and comments by email through our website, www.interfaithdialogueassociation.org. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads. This is Common Threads, an interfaith dialogue.
I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Kelly Clark. He's the author of a book entitled A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. And today, we will continue that conversation. Kelly Clark has had a pretty impressive and diverse academic career. He has a PhD from Notre Dame, and he's held positions at Calvin, Oxford, and St. Andrews, as well as with the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, the parent organization of Interfaith Dialogue Association, and he is the former executive director of the Society of Christian Philosophers. So we welcome once again to the microphones of Common Threads, Dr. Kelly Clark. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Fred. Good to see you again.
So last week, we began our conversation talking about your book and also talking about the current situation in China, which I find fascinating. I don't know of any other country that has a relationship with religion as China does. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's unique on the face of this earth and probably for all time too. So yeah, I think it's very. I don't like a lot of it, but it's absolutely fascinating.
That is what I'm gathering.
It's an accident I cannot look away from.
I understand that. So last week we also talked about your book, which is about early Chinese thought. And the title, A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. So we talked about, we talked a little bit about gods last week. And you used the term God singular. You used the term gods plural on at least one occasion.
Yeah.
So I wanna massage that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the Western perception of ancient Chinese religion is similar to the view that is often held about Hinduism, where if you just go up to somebody on the street who only knows what he's heard on the street about Hinduism, if you ask him, do you think Hinduism is polytheist? And they'll just say, yeah. I think that is the common understanding. But you talk to a Hindu, and they're likely to push back on that. Is the same true with Western academics when they look at China, or at least how they looked at China in the past, that it's easy to just classify it as polytheistic when perhaps it does have an understanding of a prime mover, a primal unique, a first cause, etc.?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. Let me just muddy it just a bit more. The very first paper I was asked to write was a comparison between early Chinese conceptions of divinity and early Hebrew conceptions of divinity. Actually, what they wanted was a Christian view of God and a Confucian view of God. And I had already looked into a lot of different texts in early China and thought, I'm not going to limit myself to Confucius. I'm going to look at these other texts. And Christianity is interesting, but it's late. We're not talking about the same time period. Let's talk about something that's roughly the same time period, say 200 to 400 BC. What's contemporaneous with that are the Hebrew scriptures, not the Christian scriptures. So I restricted myself to the Hebrew scriptures. And I thought I was going to prove that Christians were, the early Hebrews were monotheists and the Chinese were polytheists. That's what I thought, polytheism bad, monotheism good. That's what I thought I was going to find. And what I came to see really clearly is when God says, you shall have no other gods before me, there were other gods right there in the Hebrew Bible, lots of them, and they're called by name, and there were confrontations between gods. And the early Hebrews believed in lots of gods. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Other people had their gods. Other cities had their gods. So Baal was a god. Asherah was a god. There were all sorts of gods in the Hebrew Bible. And the thing I learned about early Chinese thought was there were lots of lesser gods, which were, God isn't the best term for it, lesser deities, lesser powers greater than humans. But there was one high god clear in everything. So the high god was clear, not so clear in the Hebrew Bible. So it just totally went counter to my expectations. And so in China, there is and has been in history in the texts that we have, and there aren't lots of texts, but in the ones that we have, it's clear that there's a high God. The high God has different names. D is one name, like the sort of generic name for God, and Shangdi literally means high God or Lord God or something like that. And then Tian, heaven. And heaven becomes the preferred name for God in the time of Confucius, but all the names are used. Di, Shangdi, and Tian, they're all used. They're all the high God. A lot of people say China doesn't have a creation story, doesn't believe in a creator God. That isn't true. There probably are at least 20 different references to belief in a high God in quasi-authoritative Chinese texts and even creation stories in here. So there's one high creator God, and then all these other ones, gods of rivers, gods of the weather. There are ghosts running around that are the malevolent spirits that are sometimes called gods, or deities. They would be lesser gods, but there's one high God that roughly is in control of everything, including history. So, and wants something like the kingdom of God. It's called the mandate of heaven. And it's the key political philosophy throughout all of Chinese history is the mandate of heaven. And the mandate of heaven is the person that has the right to rule. Someone may have the power and rule. Someone may have power and rule, but they may not have the right to rule. I take it Hitler had power and ruled, but he didn't rule by right. And he usurped somebody else's right. And in Chinese history, there's a pattern in that when a wicked ruler comes along, God will remove his mandate, the right to rule, from that house. And then it will pass on to another house. And that legitimates a violent overthrow, for example. Somebody could exercise violence against the ruling house rightly. You know, violence in general isn't good, but it's okay when a ruler has become unjust. It's okay to overthrow them and then let God give someone the right to rule, and also the power. They're going to need power, but they'll rule by right. They'll be just and kind and compassionate. That God's on the side of that, and God works through history to do that.
Sounds similar to the divine right of kings in England,
yeah.
Except you can be a real SOB and be a king of England and still supposedly have that divine, not anymore, but back in the day.
Yeah, well, I think that's why it ended up getting overthrown. If the kings were all nice, there'd still be kings there.
So let's move on to ancestors.
By the way, the Chinese... Oh, yeah. Kings weren't so nice either. It's not like you found a whole unsullied line of great and moral and virtuous kings. That didn't happen. But the principle was
yes,
there.
Yes. So what about ancestors? That's another thing that I'm guessing that a lot of people who know very little about Chinese spirituality would say, oh yeah, Chinese, they do that ancestor worship thing. How do ancestors play a part in ancient Chinese spirituality and even perhaps today? Are they like saints, say perhaps in Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy, where prayers to them can result in boons and favors?
Well, okay, so I think they've come to that latter status for some people. I don't really like the term ancestor worship. I prefer the term ancestor appeasement. It's pretty clear that when in ancient China, that when people died, that the greatest fear was that your ancestor was going to become a malevolent ghost. They're going to be a ghost. The greatest fear was that they were going to be malevolent. And so there was a prayer called a summoning prayer, which when your ancestor dies, but before they're entombed, their spirit can go running off somewhere. And the summoning prayer is to bring the soul back. Oh, soul, come back, is the start of the summoning prayer. And you want the soul back in that body because you want it to go in the tomb. And then you want either to put a big heavy rock on top of the tomb. Peasants just dug holes in the ground and put rocks on top, but the rich people would have big elaborate entrances to a tomb. They may have an elaborate tomb. And then you roll a big door, stone door, and so they're stuck. You don't want them to come out.
Nothing keeps a ghost inside like a big rock.
No, I know big that. Rocks. Well, their soul can separate. And so what you do is try to keep it happy in the tomb. And so you might have a table with chairs and food. You might have a table and chairs and then a list of all the good things you did. And then you hope that the god that just like Santa Claus sees if you're naughty or nice, there's mm-hmm. a god that's the keeper of the records. You hope that that god comes and sits down with you and sees that you're worried. Sees that you're good. And if you're good, turns you over to the god of eternal life. And then you hope that that god puts you on a dragon and takes you away to heaven. That's what you hope. And that's what your ancestors hope, because they do not want you to turn into a malevolent ghost. That's what they really don't want in ancient China. They do things like set a table. There's a corner for the kitchen god. There are all sorts of ways that they are trying to keep the malevolent ghosts at hand. Now, there is ancestor worship. No one had a personal relationship with Di, Shang Di, or Tian. No one had a personal relationship with God. Your most immediate religious practices were with your ancestors. Mm-hmm. And you did hope that your ancestors might take your prayers up to the high God, you hope that they would just stay out of your affairs, but that they might take your fervent prayers to the high God. And let me just say one more thing. The only person that approached the high God was the king. And
the living king?
Yeah, the living king. Well, the deceased king might be up there with him too. Mm-hmm. So the deceased king might have a privileged position even in heaven. But once a year, there was a ceremony that ritual specialists did for the high God. And the high God, basically, I think the point of it was the high God had to say, I'm not God, and had to bow and had to, it was his time to say, I'm a creature. I'm not a God. And, so I am subject to God too. You're subject to me. My subjects are subject to me. I'm subject to God. So I can't just do whatever I want. So once a year, I think the king was reminded, had to be reminded that he wasn't a god. And then everyone would be there. Like everyone was in their place and there was music playing and ceremony and everyone would see this. And I think it was supposed to, and we know this, that activity that people do in concert with one another, if you sway to the music together with people, if you sing the music together, that coordinated activity like that makes people more cooperative. And so I think there was a kind of profound psychology, mm-hmm. both in the king having to bow before the people at the feet of God, not their feet, but also for all the people acting in coordination. I think it could make society more cooperative, because that's a problem for early human groups. It was a problem in China, and almost all of early Chinese texts are how can people live together in peace? That's what they're almost all about.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today, Dr. Kelly Clark. We're talking about his book, A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. So very briefly, let's talk about afterlife in a little bit more depth. We have been, of course, with ancestors. And by the way, as you explained it further, the ancestors really do seem to resonate with Catholic saints in that I know a lot of people believe that Catholics believe that the saints actually offer the boons and favors, but in fact, they act like the ancestors. They are the ones who petition God the Father to grant the boons of mere mortals. So that's quite interesting. So afterlife, interestingly, I, as you and many other Westerners, went through most of my life thinking that God was either not a part of ancient Chinese spirituality or sort of an afterthought. So I didn't see the word God. When I read Taoism or Confucianism or whatever, I didn't see the word God, but I saw the word heaven a lot. And it always occurred to me, how can you have an afterlife without a presiding deity, some cosmic force that would create a heaven in the first place for you to go to?
Yeah.
So what is heaven according to ancient Chinese thought? And yeah, what about hell, or hells, plural?
Yeah. So heaven can mean, in early Chinese thought, three things. And one is just sky, the heavens and the earth can mean just the sky. Sometimes the term heavens and earth can mean God. Mm. Heaven can mean sky. Heaven can mean a place where people go after they die if they're good. So it's a place. And heaven is also the most common proper name for God after about 700 BC. So it can be a proper name for God. And you have to decide from the context what it is. In some Taoist writings, heaven is sort of a natural force that includes a little bit of a force for good, but not that much. In classical philosophical Taoism, there isn't a big distinction between good and evil. There's just what's natural, just go with it. So heaven could mean any one of those three things. I have a quotation here. So King Wen is the most important king in Confucianism. And King Wen, when he died, this is from an ancient classic called the Book of Poetry. It says, King Wen is on high, oh, he shines in heaven. So he's in a place, it's on high, it's up above earth, he's in heaven. And then it says, his dynasty, it says, was illustrious. It was blessed by God's charge, by the divine mandate, which I talked about last time. And then it says, King Wen ascends and descends. He ascends into heaven. And then he descends, so heaven's a place, on God's left hand, on his right. And so he ascends into heaven and then sits next to heaven, sits next to God. So heaven is used as a proper name. It's also kind of a, like heaven is above, a little bit like sky. Although heaven isn't located literally above in the sky, heaven is located like way in the north of China. People thought they might go there. At any rate, heaven's a proper name for God sometimes. It's a name for a place where people go if they're good. I should say this. The Chinese told us that the Chinese don't believe in God. They don't believe in an afterlife. So one of my former students, who's a world-class cognitive scientist of religion, we trained six Chinese psychologists in cognitive science of religion, and they went back to China and did some of the first studies. And one was just on afterlife beliefs, like what do people believe? And the person that did that said, well, the Chinese don't believe in an afterlife. And he did it with students at the university he taught at. And over 60% of his students believed in an afterlife. He was totally shocked. So the very first published study, and this is after 50 years of communism trying to beat out religious belief, that over 60% believed. He was totally shocked. Anyway, that was the first piece of cognitive science of religion out of China. We've done a number of other studies. Books have been published. It's hard to do studies in China, I'll say that, on religion. Anyway, you ask about hell. There is a hell in China. So you also, the Chinese think people have two souls. They have a body and two souls. I mean, not the Chinese. In some texts, we read there's a body and two souls. And one of your souls is just going to stay in the tomb with the body. That's your hope. The other soul, the one that's a source of reason and emotion, you hope it doesn't go down to the Yellow Springs. And then there are descriptions in the hell-like descriptions of the Yellow Springs. So people say there's no heaven, there's no hell. Again, that's just not true. We don't know how widespread it was believed. My guess is probably pretty widespread. But we only have, you know, 30 texts that say what people believed. And I'll qualify that just a little bit, and this changed what I thought a lot. There's a lot of things found in tombs. So I have a chapter called Tomb Text and Architecture, that you can find paintings in tombs that reveal a three-part world with heaven, this life, and hell. So, in fact, I just read, I'll say this for your listeners, Lady Di, you can look it up. They found her body. A lot of tombs have been uncovered in China in the last 40 or 50 years, and it's been an unbelievable source of information about religious beliefs and practices. Unbelievable. And one of them was Lady Di, and she was the wife of a marquis, and she had a really elaborate tomb. Her body is still intact. I didn't know this. I just happened to read this week in the news, they had a photograph of her body, which has been preserved for, I don't know, 2,200 years or something like that. So next time I teach Lady Di, I'm going to show people what she looked like, which is not so good. Not so good after 2,200 years. But anyway, she had a painting with her on a dragon flying to heaven. There's a painting of her in the middle of this. It's a three-part painting of her in the middle, just her ordinary life with her family there, trying to say how good she was. And there also was the third part, which they didn't want her to go to, the bottom part, which was, it's just a painting, so we don't know what they called it, but something like the Yellow River, the hell-like place. Yellow Springs, sorry, that she wanted to avoid.
Did you know there's a trailer park in Barnard, Mississippi named Yellow Springs?
Well, yeah, and you don't want to go there, I heard.
We just have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about Falun Gong and this elaborate show called Shenyong. Do you know anything about that?
I know about Falun Gong. One of the very first times I went, there was a Chinese woman who was very unhappy with how the Chinese government treated the Falun Gong. I'll just quickly say how they treated them. Mm-hmm. Most of them were arrested in China, put in really high security prison. Very likely they were killed and their organs were harvested and given to people that needed transplant. So unbelievably harsh treatment of the Falun Gong. Why would the government do that? Because in the 19th century, there was a rebellion called the Taipei Rebellion, and the rebellion was an apocalyptic figure who claimed to be Jesus' brother. Mm-hmm. And he came within days, probably, of capturing the capital of China and taking over China for this apocalyptic rule. He had millions of followers for some reason. This is before the internet. I don't know how it happened. At any rate, the Chinese live in fear that some religion is going to usurp their power. And so when they see this, especially if it's apocalyptic, when they see it, they crush it. So I'll just give an example. The Chinese Communist Party selects the leader of the Three Self Church, which is the Three Self Patriotic Movement, which is basically a Protestant Christian church. And that leader says what can be taught. You cannot teach the book of Revelation. Nothing apocalyptic. You cannot teach that. So that's gone from the Bibles at the back of the church in the three self-patriotic movement. So they're really afraid of threats to their power. And it's based on this Taiping Rebellion. And Falun Gong was viewed as a threat to its power. So this woman talked about it, and this was around the time Harry Potter had come out, and she talked about the Chinese present at the time is "He Who Must Not Be Named," mm-hmm. And then Falun Gong was "It Which Cannot Be Named," and she gave her whole talk. Of course, everyone knew what she was talking about, but she didn't want it in print. The "He Who Must Not Be Named," the evil person, and the "It that Must Not Be Named," Falun Gong, and it was a really clever critique of the Chinese treatment of the Falun Gong.
Wow. Kelly, we're out of time for this edition, as we were last week, right in the middle of something very interesting. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but I want to thank you for your time last week as well as today.
Thank you, Fred.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Dr. Kelly Clark. The book we've been talking about is A Spiritual Geography of Early Chinese Thought, Gods, Ancestors, and Afterlife. Please join us again next week on Common Threads here on WGVU.
Common Threads is a production of WGVU in cooperation with the Interfaith Dialogue Association. The views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the station, its underwriters, or Grand Valley State University. In many cases, the participants on this program represent themselves and may not be designated spokespeople for the faiths they represent. Send questions and comments by email through our website, www.interfaithdialogueassociation.org. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.